So we're reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 8, and we're covering text 143 through 146. So that's the verse that's on the board, the last of those verses. We'll just read the English of the first couple. Text 143, Krishna is all attractive for all devotional mellows because he is the personification of the conjugal mellow. Krishna is attractive not only to all the devotees, but to himself as well. So in our talks today, I'm going to cover that particular theme. It's kind of an interesting one. It sounds like the ultimate egotist. You know, when you think of it, you know, objectively, it sounds like that. He's all attractive, and he's attractive to everyone, including himself. Very attracted to himself. So it's an interesting concept. And this is from the Gita Govinda, this next verse. My dear friends, just see how Sri Krishna is enjoying the season of spring. With the gopis embracing each of his limbs, he is like amorous love personified. With his transcendental pastimes, he enlivens all the gopis and the entire creation. With his soft bluish black arms and legs, which resemble blue lotus flowers, he has created a festival for Cupid. Text 145. He also attracts Narayana, the incarnation of Sankarsana, and the husband of the goddess of fortune. He attracts not only Narayana, but all women headed by the goddess of fortune, the consort of Narayana. So now we're up to today's verse. So addressing Krishna and Arjuna, Lord Mahavishnu, the Mahapurusha, said, I wanted to see both of you, and therefore I have brought the sons of the Brahmana here. Both of you have appeared in the material world to reestablish religious principles, and you have both appeared here with all your potencies. After killing all the demons, please quickly return to the spiritual world. Purport. This is a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10.89.58, concerning Krishna's endeavor to take Arjuna beyond the material universe, when Arjuna was searching for the sons of a Brahmana. Lord Mahavishnu, who is situated beyond this material world, was also attracted by the bodily features of Krishna. Mahavishnu had actually stolen the sons of the Brahmana in Dwarka so that Krishna and Arjuna would come visit him. This verse is quoted to show that Krishna is so attractive that he attracts Mahavishnu. So this is quite an extraordinary concept. You think about this magnificent being that creates all the universes, expands all these universes, and has this very prominent place in the spiritual sky. And yet he was eager to see Krishna. So you can wonder, there's a lot of questions that come up because of this particular pastime, which I'll get into. But it's an extraordinary story, as Krishna's pastimes are always extraordinary. They're not ordinary, in other words. So this is an interesting incident. This is prior to the Battle of Kurukshetra. It took place in the kingdom of Dwarka. And a Brahmana's wife gave birth to a child in the kingdom. And as soon as it was born, the child immediately died, and the Brahmin then went to the palace and was complaining to Ugrasena, who was at that time the king. Ugrasena, as I guess all or most of you know, Ugrasena was the grandfather of Krishna, and he was made the king by Krishna. So they were complaining to Ugrasena, this Brahmin was complaining, what kind of king are you that something like this can happen in your kingdom. Now, that seems like a pretty high standard. It was expected in those days that the king was supposed to protect the citizens from any kind of mishap or any kind of harm. Even if it was too hot or too cold, he was held responsible. So he would be in a lot of trouble right now, apparently. Now, of course, such a standard is not possible in this age. But at that time, during the time of Yudhisthira, during the time of Ugrasena, and while Krishna was present on this earth, a king was held responsible for anything that went wrong. Just imagine having such a responsibility. Anything goes wrong, it's your fault. So, you know, that's quite a heavy thing. So anyway, he was complaining that the king, what kind of king, and he was making so many complaints. And then after that, this same brahmana he had several more children. In fact, he had up to 9 children. And each one of them immediately upon birth disappeared. And no one could seem to do anything about it. He complained that in the presence of Balaram, in the presence of Krishna, in the presence, what kind of kshatriyas do we have that can't protect? You know, so you know, as you know, kshatriyas are supposed to protect the citizens. So he was bitterly complaining. And Prabhupada discusses a little bit in the Krishna book what they call a kshatriya who's not really a legitimate kshatriya. It means one who has the title but not the qualities and not the capacity. So he was called the Kshatrabandhu, just a friend of the kshatriyas, just like we say Brahmabandhu. Not a real Brahmin, just a, what they call a friend of the Brahmins. So he was really creating quite a stir in the kingdom. And at one point, he actually was complaining, and Arjuna and Krishna were present. And he said, so Arjuna was a little disconcerted that this Brahmin was complaining like this, that there are no qualified kshatriyas. So this was his complaint. And Arjuna became inquisitive, and he approached him. He said, my dear Brahmana, why do you say that there's no proper kshatriyas to protect the citizens of your country? Is there not even someone who can pretend to be a kshatriya? Who can carry a bow and arrow at least to make a show of protection? Do you think that all the royal personalities in this country simply engage in performing sacrifices with the brahmanas but have no chivalrous power? So he's challenging him kind of in a way like saying, what you're claiming is impossible. So he raised this challenge, and he says, if the brahmanas feel unwanted separation from their wives and children, Arjuna continued, and the kshatriya kings do not take care of them, then such kshatriyas are to be considered no better than stage players. In dramatic performances in the theater, an actor may play the part of a king, but no one expects any benefits from such a make-believe king. Similarly, if the king or executive head of state cannot give protection to the head of the social structure, he is considered merely a bluffer. Such executive heads simply live for their own livelihood while occupying exalted posts as chiefs of state. My lord, I promise that I shall give protection unto your children. And if I am unable to do so, then I shall enter into blazing fire, so that the sinful contamination which has infected me will be counteracted. So the Brahmana was kind of impressed by Arjuna's oratory, but he didn't take it too seriously. He said, I live in a kingdom where Balaram is present, where Krishna is present, all these powerful persons, even the sons of Krishna are present. So how do you expect me to take you seriously? And for a kshatriya, saying something like that to a kshatriya, I don't know if you can imagine, if any of you have kshatriya background, but that's a highly insulting thing to say to a kshatriya. I don't take you seriously. They have a pretty powerful egos, the Kshatriyas generally. So when he was challenged like that, he said, this is what the Brahmin said, I consider your promise to be like that of an inexperienced child. I cannot put my faith in your promise. So then Arjuna got, as we say in, I don't know if it's American or British parlance, he said that got Krishna's dander, Arjuna's dander up, which means it got his temper a little bit inflamed. So then he spoke words which are really a little bit insulting to Krishna, because he'd already mentioned that Balaram and Krishna were present, yet you know, nothing's been done about my son's dying. So how can I, you know, why should I take you seriously? So then, here's Arjuna's response. My dear Brahmana, I am neither Sankarsan nor Krishna, nor one of Krishna's sons like Pradyumna or Aniruddha. My name is Arjuna, and I carry the bow known as Gandiva. You cannot insult me, for I have satisfied even Lord Shiva by my powers, by my prowess when we were both hunting in the forest. I had a fight with Lord Shiva, who appeared before me as a hunter, and when I satisfied him by my prowess, he gave me the weapon known as Pashupatastra. Pashupatastra. Do not doubt my chivalry. I shall bring back your sons, even if I have to fight with death personified. So he's saying, even if I had to fight with Yamaraj, I shall fight your, bring back your sons. So when the Brahmana was assured by Arjuna in such exalted words, he was somehow or other convinced, and thus he returned home. So then, so when this Brahmana's wife was about to give birth again, she began to chant, the Brahmana began to chant, my dear Arjuna, please come now and save my child. So Arjuna came there fully equipped with all of his weaponry. He was ready to fight with whoever was going to come to face him. Nevertheless, the child disappeared. So if you can just imagine how the Brahmana felt. And he said some very strong words. Actually, in the 10th canto, I know that Prabhupada's given us the summary, but in the 10th canto, the Brahmana uses some really harsh language to Arjuna. So this is the milder version I'm going to read you now. Maybe I should have read the harsh, but anyway, it's interesting to see how he spoke to Arjuna. He said, so in front of Krishna and others, he accused Arjuna, everyone see my foolishness. I put my faith in the words of Arjuna, who is impotent and who is expert only in false promises. How foolish I was to believe Arjuna. He promised to protect my child when even Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Lord Balaram, and Lord Krishna failed. If such great personalities could not protect my child, then who can do so? I therefore condemn Arjuna for his false promise. And I also condemn his celebrated bow, Gandiva, and his impudence in declaring himself greater than Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. No one can save my child, for he has already been transferred to another planet. Due to sheer foolishness only, Arjuna thought he could bring back my child from another planet. Well, now, Arjuna was of course, quite upset about this whole situation. And being very much condemned by this Brahmin, I didn't know this, and I'd forgotten about this anyway. I'd read it years ago. And apparently Arjuna had mastered the mystic yoga process in his time in exile. He had the powers of a mystic yogi. So he was able to go to various planetary systems. So since this Brahmana had speculated that the baby must, or the sons must be on a different planet, he began to travel. He said, first of all, he went to the planet known as Yamaloka, where the superintendent of death, Yamaraj, lives. Then there he searched for the Brahma's baby, couldn't find him. Then he went to Indra's planet, couldn't find him. Then it mentions the fire planets of the fire demigods, then the Nairiti demigods. Don't ask me who the Nairiti demigods are because I don't know. But they were powerful beings. And then to the moon planet. Then he went to Vayu and Varuna Loka. So Vayu, you know, god of the air, and Varuna, the ocean, the ocean god. Couldn't find the baby anywhere. Then he went down to the Rasatala planet. Then Brahmaloka. Even mystic yogis can't go to Brahmaloka, generally. You have to be specially qualified to go there. Then he had the power to, he went above the heavenly planets to Brahmaloka, and he searched all the planets. So he came back and he took a vow. He'd already taken the vow, but he was prepared to enter fire to satisfy this Brahman, at least today. Okay, I said either I would get them or I would enter the fire, so I'm going to do that. But then Arjuna stopped him. He said, don't enter the fire in disgrace. Don't worry, I'll take you where you need to go. So it's interesting how Krishna prolonged this whole thing and made Arjuna go through all these steps, you could say. But anyway, he said, if he were to enter the fire in hopelessness, indirectly it would be a blemish on Krishna. In other words, it would be look bad for me if you entered the fire because you couldn't keep your promise. So do not foolishly commit suicide. So he called it a... And there was another occasion in Mahabharata where, I don't know if you remember, where Arjuna was going to commit suicide. And Krishna had to prevent him. So then Krishna called for his chariot. Now this chariot was no ordinary chariot. He's playing the part of a human being. Krishna's playing the part of a human being in his pastimes. Of course he could have brought back this child immediately if he'd wanted to. But Krishna's pastimes are full of mystery. For some reason, he wanted Arjuna to go through all this. He wanted the Brahman to lament about his lost sons. And this apparently was to satisfy, there's many reasons, but one of the reasons was to satisfy Mahavishnu, who wanted to see Krishna and Arjuna directly. So, to protect his friend, he decided to take him to see Mahavishnu. So they got on this chariot, they proceeded north, and they came through all the, they went through all the different planetary systems, through all the layers surrounding the earth, the eight layers. And they came to this situation outside of the eight layers, which was in darkness. It was very, very dark. No one could see, there was nothing you could see, couldn't see anything. So, these four horses, the four horses of Krishna, were also residents of Vaikuntha. They were not regular horses. Can't expect Krishna to have regular horses. Shaibya, Sugriva, Megapushpa, and Palahaka. So they showed some hesitation about entering the darkness. And it's explained by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. This is also pastime. In other words, they actually had no fear, but they showed some hesitation. But then Krishna, he took the Sudarshana Chakra and he released his disc, and the disc preceded them as they passed through this darkness. And it says it illuminated the sky 1,000 times brighter than sunlight. Now, it's hard to imagine something 1,000 times greater than sunlight, but it has that type of intensity, the effulgence of the Brahmajyoti, the Sudarshana Chakra. So he enters the darkness, and then there's a description which is so nice. I think it's there's Prabhupada's prose is often like poetry in my estimation. It's prose. It's not technically poetry, but the way he describes things very, not only concisely but poetically. He says, Arjuna then saw the effulgence of light known as the Brahmajyoti. The Brahmajyoti is situated outside the covering of the material universes, and because it cannot be seen with our present eyes, this Brahmajyoti is sometimes called avyakta. This spiritual effulgence is the ultimate destination of the impersonalists known as Vedantists. The Brahmajyoti is also described as anantaparam, unlimited and unfathomed. No limits to it. No limit in terms of depth or height or width. Jai Jai Shri Radha Gokulananda Jai Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Jai Gornitai Jai Prabhupada. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna reached this region of the Brahmajyoti, Arjuna could not tolerate the glaring effulgence and he closed his eyes. Lord Krishna's and Arjuna's reaching the Brahmajyoti region is described in the Harivamsa. In that portion of the Vedic literature, Krishna informs Arjuna, "My dear Arjuna, the glaring effulgence, the transcendental light you are seeing, is my bodily rays. O chief of the descendants of Bharata, this Brahmajyoti is I myself." So sometimes people get confused by this too. They think, oh, well, if the Brahmajyoti is Krishna, then why can't I just worship the Brahmajyoti? Well, Brahmajyoti is also worshipable. It's an emanation of Krishna. Sarva kalvi dhang brahma, everything is actually Krishna, including his effulgence. So to say that the effulgence is Krishna is also accurate, philosophically true. So he says, this Brahmajyoti is I myself. As the sun disk and the sunshine cannot be separated, Krishna and his bodily rays, the Brahmajyoti, cannot be separated. Thus, Krishna claims that the Brahmajyoti is he himself. So the impersonalists are onto something. They're worshiping Brahmajyoti. It's a good step forward. So we shouldn't get too critical about people who are attached to the Brahmajyoti. This is clearly stated in the Harivamsa when Krishna says, Ahamsa. The Brahmajyoti is a combination of the minute particles known as spiritual sparks or the living entities known as chitkana. The Vedic word soham, or I am the Brahmajyoti, can also be applied to the living entities. So in other words, the Brahmajyoti is the sparks of the living beings. They're sparks, little sparks. That's us, little sparks. So we can also claim to belong to the Brahmajyoti. So this is interesting that Krishna invokes this expression, soham. I remember back in the, I guess it was the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, there was a so-called guru. And he taught this that as a mantra for his followers to chant, soham. I am that, meaning I am God, basically. I am that. So this is often used by the impersonalists to declare themselves, their own divinity, declare their divinity or their equality with God, soham. So so this was the experience. They experienced this Brahmajyoti. And they they came into the area in the Karna Ocean. There's a great description. I wanted to read part of it. Where is it? Sorry. Anyway, it's described that there was like a hurricane of effulgence in the kingdom of Mahavishnu. There were palaces, there were enormous columns, spectacularly ornamented with spiritual jewels, very radiant under the Karana ocean. So just, it's sort of hard to imagine, but there's this vast ocean, Karana ocean, where Mahavishnu resides in this fantastic kingdom and palaces. And it gives a description. He had eight arms, Mahavishnu, eight arms, lying on the bed of Anantasesha, the white, soft body of Anantasesha with thousands of hoods. So you can imagine, and he was vast, he's huge. Apparently, the form of Mahavishnu was enormous. So Arjuna was rather, you know, I don't know if the right word is intimidated, but he was awestruck by this. And it says that the Lord was surrounded by his personal associates, Nanda and Sunanda. They were always like his right and left hand, Nanda and Sunanda. And the Sudarshan disc, the person, because the disc is not just a disc, it's also a being. It's also a personality. So that personality who was the Sudarshan Chakra was standing there as well. And also important personalities, Pushti, the energy for nourishment, Shri, the energy of beauty. These are all beings as well. Kirti, the energy of reputation. That's also an energy and a person. The energy of reputation. And Aja, the energy of material creation. We're all standing there and greeting the Lord. And then Lord Krishna actually offered his respects to Mahavishnu. He paid obeisances to Mahavishnu. Now this, of course, was bewildering. It says here, in Prabhupada giving this explanation, he says, this means that he offered obeisances unto him only because Lord Mahavishnu is none different than he himself. So it also mentions in Dwarka, in the Krishna book, that in the morning when Krishna would get up, he would begin to meditate on himself. He would do his meditation, but it was on himself. But that's not for anybody else. That's just for Krishna. Anyway, so he offered his obeisances. And, of course, Arjuna, when he saw that, there was no necessity for Krishna to offer his obeisances, but he did it anyway because he's a teacher. Prabhupada says he's a master teacher. So he did it. And Arjuna was, as we said, very intimidated by the immense size of Mahavishnu and the things he was seeing, things he'd never seen before. It's just like he was so amazed when Krishna demonstrates later, because this is prior to the battle of Kurukshetra. But later when he showed the universal form, Arjuna was pretty awestruck by that also, and even fearful. It describes in one place that he was simultaneously blissful and fearful. I don't know if anybody experienced that emotion, a combination before. Blissful and fear, afraid. Probably a good response to God. At least for us beginners. Anyway, he offered his obeisances and stood before him with his folded hands. And then Mahavishnu speaks. And I'm going to go into that. This leads us up to this verse that we're just now reading. Let's see if I can... No, I won't attempt to go back to it, but this is basically what he had to say. My dear Krishna and Arjuna, I was very anxious to see you both, and therefore I arranged to take away the babies of the Brahmana and keep them here. I have been expecting to see you both at this palace. You have appeared in the material world as my incarnations in order to minimize the force of the demoniac persons who burden the world. Now, after killing all these unwanted demons, you will please come back to me. Both of you are incarnations of the great sage Narayana. Although you are both complete in yourselves to protect the devotees and to annihilate the demons, and especially to establish religious principles in the world so that peace and tranquility may continue, you are teaching the basic principles of factual religion so that the people of the world may follow you and therefore be peaceful and prosperous. So, now to go to the Bhagavatam now, to the that's the summary study of the 10th canto. This is the translation of the specific verse that we just mentioned. He said, Lord Mahavishnu said, I brought the Brahmana's sons here because I wanted to see the two of you, my expansions who have descended to the earth to save the principles of religion. As soon as you finish killing the demons who burden the earth, quickly come back here to me. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there was a secret reason. It says, you two, who have descended along with your kalas, your personal energies, should kindly return to me after killing the demons who burden the earth. Please quickly send these demons here to me for the sake of their liberation. So he's already taking care of the demons that Krishna's killing. It is stated in the Sri Hari Vamsa and in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that the path of gradual liberation passes through the immediate station of Lord Mahavishnu's abode outside the eighth shell of the universe. And then, this is the part that I think is especially interesting, because this sort of explains this pastime to some degree anyway, as far as it can be understood. Having seen the domain of Lord Vishnu, Arjuna was totally amazed. He concluded that whatever extraordinary power a person exhibits can only be a manifestation of Sri Krishna's mercy. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes Arjuna's amazement. He thought, just see, even though I am a mere mortal, by Krishna's mercy I have seen the Supreme Godhead, the root cause of everything. Then, after a moment, he thought again, but why? Why did Lord Vishnu say that he took away the Brahmana's children out of a desire to see Krishna? So this doesn't make any sense. He's thinking Mahavishnu is God and Krishna's my friend. A great, powerful personality, no doubt, but he's my friend. So why would Mahavishnu go to the trouble to kill all these children just so that Krishna would come and visit him? He's asking. Why would the Supreme Personality of Godhead hanker to see his own expansion? So he's actually thinking the way many people within the confines of Hinduism think, that Krishna is simply an expansion, not the original Godhead. So he said this might be the effect of some peculiar temporary circumstance, but since he said didrikshuna instead of didrikshata, where the specific suffix shuna carries the sense of a permanent characteristic, not a temporary one, it has to be concluded that he has always been wanting to see Krishna and myself. So this is Arjuna expressing his own amazement. Why in the world would God or Mahavishnu want to see us? Why? Even granted that this is so, why couldn't he simply see Krishna at Dwarka? So why didn't he just come see him at Dwarka if he wants to see him? After all, Lord Mahavishnu is the all-pervading creator of the universe, which he holds like an amalaka fruit in his hand. Is it that he could not see Krishna at Dwarka because Krishna does not allow anyone to see him without his special sanction? So he's raising a question. Is that what's going on? And why also would Lord Mahavishnu, the compassionate master of all Brahmanas, have repeatedly tormented an elevated Brahmana year after year? So here's an important question. Why would why would he torment this poor Brahmana? 9 children? How is that a nice thing? In other words, that doesn't sound very nice. So he says, he must have acted in this unusual way only because he could not give up his extreme eagerness to see Krishna. All right, he may have acted improperly for that reason, but why couldn't he have sent a servant to kidnap the Brahmana's sons? Why did he himself have to come to Dwarka? Was stealing them out of Lord Krishna's capital so difficult that no one but Vishnu himself could hope to accomplish it? So he's raising all the questions. This is Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur raising questions on behalf of Arjuna. So this great acharya is speaking on Arjuna's behalf. I can understand that he intended to cause so much distress to a brahmana of Lord Krishna's city that Krishna would be unable to tolerate it. So seeing this brahmana in such distress, Arjuna is speculating that Krishna wouldn't be able to tolerate this brahmana's distress. Then he would grant Lord Vishnu his audience. Lord Vishnu inspired the distressed brahmana to pour out his complaints to Krishna in person. Thus, it is clear that Sri Krishna's status of godhood is superior to Lord Mahavishnu's. So in other words, that Mahavishnu would go to this much trouble just to get Krishna to come see him was an indication of Krishna's two-armed form to be the ultimate supreme form of godhood. So this is the conclusion of the Vaishnavacharyas. Having thought in this way, Arjuna was totally amazed. He asked Lord Krishna whether these were actually the facts of the matter, and the Lord replied, as related in the Harivamsa, "It was to see me that he, the Supreme Soul, stole the children. He believed only on a Brahmana's behalf will Krishna come to see me, not otherwise." In other words, Krishna wouldn't even bother to go see him otherwise, except to take the side of a Brahmana. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur states that Lord Krishna further told Arjuna, "I did not go there, however, for the Brahmana's sake. I went there, my friend, just to save your life. If it had been for the Brahmana's sake that I traveled to Vaikuntha, I would have done so after his first child was abducted." According to Srila Sridhar Swami, although this pastime occurred before the Battle of Kurukshetra, it is recounted here at the end of the 10th canto under the general heading of the supremacy of Lord Krishna's glories. So the latter chapters of the 10th canto are kind of like a recitation of Krishna's attractiveness and his glories. It just explains how everyone and everything, I mean, even as it's stated in this verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the theme there in this talks with Ramananda Roy, the theme is how attractive Krishna is. He's so attractive that even the Mahavishnu is attracted to him. Everyone and everything is attracted to him. So he's all, you know, we say all attractive. The Krishna is all attractive. So this is the case. So this is quite a mysterious pastime. Sometimes people might question, well, why? Why would Krishna bother to do all that? He doesn't, a lot of, if you really examine the pastimes of Krishna, he does one amazing thing after the next. And you can't necessarily give some logical explanation of why he does things. He does things because he feels like it. Sometimes small children, you ask them why they did something that seems strange, they'll say, "I wanted to. I want to." And my son used to say that. We ask him when he did something particularly peculiar or strange, "Why did you do that?" "Oh, I want to." That was his explanation. He thought that was a sufficient explanation. Well, in Krishna's case, it is a sufficient explanation. He wanted to exhibit his pastimes in this way, and he did it. And he was enjoying it, and so were his associates. So I'll stop there, see if there's any questions, comments, or condemnations, or whatever. No?
Yes.
Thank you. Beautiful class. I have some question regarding Brahmajyoti.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know much about it anyway, but as we know, you said also it's comprised from tiny, tiny sparks.
It's working.
Living entities, that thing is gone. So, like, entering Brahmajyoti is not considered to be liberation. The three ones, like Sarupa, Salokya, Sashti, which is same feature, same opulence, the same abode. So how is that then these jivas are so many? Because Brahmajyoti is unlimited, and they're all sparks of living entities. How there is so many there? And also, if they are not liberated, how that they are within spiritual, which is Brahmajyoti is spiritual also. So it's kind of like how so many of them is there? Because this is just, it's mentioned that there is much more liberated person than conditioned. And if those jivas are not liberated, how that there are so many of them within spiritual Brahmajyoti?
Well, it's not exactly correct. They are liberated. Those who merge into the Brahmajyoti, they are liberated souls. But that liberation is of temporary nature. As is stated in the Bhagavatam, that they will again, those who are simply, who achieve the Brahmajyoti, they will have to come back to this world because they don't have any way to put their desire to be active. They have a desire to be active. So in the Brahmajyoti, there's no question of activity. So the jivas are coming back to this material world to become active. He describes how a lot of the impersonalists, they start doing philanthropic activities in this world because they don't know what else to do, what kind of activity. We know that in the spiritual planets, there is activity. There are personalities. There are, you know, pastimes. But in the Brahmajyoti, there's just the feeling of eternity and blissfulness, but no activity. So that desire remains unfulfilled. So it is liberation, but it has a temporary duration. Go ahead, speak. Vimukti manina, that they appear to be liberated, but it's not really. Complete without service. Anything else? Yes?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Prabhu, I recall reading somewhere, but I can't find the reference, where Srila Prabhupada says the Pandavas only live in the material world.
I can't.
I read in one of the purposes of Srila Prabhupada,
yeah,
that the Pandavas, they only have their pastimes with Krishna in the material world.
Well, certainly he exhibits his pastimes again and again with the Pandavas in the material world. So far as their situation in the spiritual world, Arjuna in other places is described to be one of the gopi associates of Krishna. I'm not sure about the other four. Maybe some of you know. But as far as I know, that's generally so, although in the case of Arjuna, he's also got his position in the spiritual world. I mean, they're not going to be fighting battles in Vaikuntha. There's no real necessity for the Kshatriya spirit in that zone because it's a place of unlimited bliss and happiness. So there's no chivalrous mood. At least, I mean, you can be chivalrous, but there's no question of battles or fighting. So, I don't know if I'm answering the question. Do you know of anything where Prabhupada says the Pandavas are situated in the spiritual kingdom as well as other types of associates?
In a conversation with Harikesh Swami at that time in Mayapur, he asked the same question. And Prabhupada said, just like Jayanitya Leela Vishnu, you know, the pastimes of Lord Krishna are eternal. At every second, he's taking birth in this material world. And the Pandavas also. So the pastimes of the Mahabharata, that's why there are so many Arjuna, so many Kunti, countless, Prabhupada said. Because it makes sense, you know, that if at every second the pastime is going on, that means another Arjuna is. But at the same time, the original ones are in the spiritual world, in the, you know, in their own Siddha Swarup form, which every one of them has a relationship with Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan.
Okay, I haven't heard that before. So apparently, they've got their situation in the spiritual world as well as the material world. Are you only the holder of the microphone?
Yes.
Any other questions or comments? There's one over here.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, just a reflection and comment on the story that you told about Rashi Krishna and Arjuna went to, you know, to see, you know, about Mahavishnu, just to sort of reflecting that because Arjuna made a vow to the Brahmana that he's going to protect his sons, so I think Krishna to keep, because Arjuna become, you know, Krishna's devotee, and Krishna wanted to sort of hold on, keep the Arjuna's vow, so that's why he maybe helped Arjuna to go, or took the Arjuna to Mahavishnu to see him.
I'm sorry, I really apologize, but I couldn't make out what you were asking.
So I'm just sort of trying to sort of connect, because Arjuna made a vow to Brahmana to protect his son. That's why Krishna then took him to. So Krishna is keeping devotee's vow. So if you surrender to Krishna, and so just to try and connect. And
yes, I mean that's also stated in Bhagavad Gita that. He told Arjuna, declare it boldly that my devotee will never perish. Right? That's in Bhagavad Gita. So in the same mood, Arjuna had made this vow, which he couldn't actually keep. You know, it was out of, you know, even to the extent that he was taking a vow that apparently at the time Krishna couldn't even make. So it was a little bit outrageous that he declared himself that I will protect you or enter the fire. So it was kind of like a foolish statement. Even the Brahmana thought it was a foolish statement. But Krishna, just to protect Arjuna, that he'd made this vow, so he had to see that it was fulfilled. You know, he took him to the spiritual world. Yeah, it's a good point. Just behind you.
Hare Krishna.
Okay.
So it's in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.2.26, it says that these souls which merge Brahmajyoti, they generally fall down again to material contamination. And in another place, Srila Prabhupada says that most of those who merge Brahmajyoti. So are there souls which never fall down from Brahmajyoti?
Yeah, I mean, he does say it. I mean, I can just assume that whatever Prabhupada says is correct and is based on Shastra. So, but generally they do fall down due to their agitation for activity. Because he uses that word, I believe, doesn't he? Generally. So he fulfills the desires of some who simply, they're happy with just being merged into the, as we used to say, the white light or the Brahmajyoti. But those are more the exceptions than the rule.
It's more like that because Prabhupada says, Vimukta Mahima, that the
those residing in the Brahmajyoti, so therefore they have to fall down again and take a birth in one of those families, namely either a wealthy family,
yeah,
devotee family, yogi family, or you know, Brahmana family.
But you know, there may be some exceptions. To every rule there are usually exceptions. So in general though, we take it that they fall down. Yes, they're more fortunate. That's good. That's another good point, because we hope that that will be, you know, we hope that that was our fate in previous lives, that, you know, if we were even that elevated. We can only hope for, you know, for the mercy of Guru and Krishna. Yeah, mostly it's sometimes described that way. I don't know about boring. It's like if, like most of us have a certain amount of fearfulness. You know, we say there's four animal propensities, but the one that Prabhupada says is prominent is fearing. And what is it that we're fearing? Why are we afraid so much? Anyone? Huh? Well, is that the thing? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? Why are you afraid? I can't hear. Okay, losing what?
Our identity, our life.
Okay, we might lose our lives, death. Of course, we definitely fear death. What else do we fear?
Uncertainty.
Uncertainty, yeah. Our uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen next. And it could be bad. It could be unfortunate. You lose everything in the end. Not only do you lose your life, you lose your friends, you lose your relatives, you lose your families, you lose your children, you lose everything. So loss. So that's the great fear. So how to go beyond that fear? That's the whole point of becoming Krishna conscious. I mean, Prabhupada himself had a name that expressed fearlessness, without fear, no fear. I remember there was a bumper sticker years ago. It was very popular in America. It just said, no fear. Like, just by bluffing, you could become fearless. No, everyone's afraid. So we want to get beyond that state. So in that sense, the reason I brought that up though is because if you're situated in the Brahmajyoti, you know that you're not this body, you're situated in fearlessness. So it's not so unfortunate. I mean, it's just like the prisoner in the prison. They say, okay, we're not going to execute you after all. How do you think he feels, or she? They're jubilant. What? I'm not going to be killed. Great. It's perfect. Of course, you're going to die soon enough, but for the time at least, it's fantastic. So being Brahman realized is no small thing. You know that you're not the body, that you're an eternal being, or at least that you're eternal. You may have some misconceptions about what and who you are, but still, you're liberated from the bodily concept. There's an element of fearlessness. So it's not so bad. But it's not the ultimate. It's not the ultimate. Okay, I think what time's supposed to be done by quarter of, right? So we'll stop there. Thank you all very much.